It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Lots to talk about today, including how not to do a GDPR privacy email. More information about a bank hack called Backswap that might be in your memory. And, of course, the deets, even some information not reported elsewhere on VPN filter. Why did the FBI tell us to reboot our routers this week? It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 665, recorded Tuesday, May 29th, 2018, VPN filter. Security Now is brought to you by Duo Security. Give anytime, anywhere access to applications based on the trustworthiness of users and devices with Duo Beyond, the Zero Trust Security Platform. Sign up for a free trial at Duo.com. And by Moogsoft. Reduce IT alerts and tickets by up to 99%. Visit Moogsoft.com to learn more and sign up for a demo. And by Eno, your intelligent assistant from Capital One. Shop online without using your real credit card number for your favorite merchant sites. For more information, visit CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. It's time for Security Now, the show where we talk about your security and privacy online with this guy right here, the king of security, Mr. Steve Gibson. Hello, Steve.
Leo, great to be with you again.
Nice
for
to see you.
665, one episode shy of the big 666, which, of course, puts it exactly two-thirds through the entire life of this podcast.
What?
We run out of digits at 999.
Yeah.
So
we're now
two-thirds of the way through.
Very nice.
We'll see. All the security problems are going to be resolved by the
time we get to 999. Are you waiting for that? Is that what's keeping you busy?
Well, yeah. By when we hit 999, everything will go quiet. No more viruses, botnets, weird stuff, nothing. It's just going to get all boring on the internet.
And then we can go home. We're
only two-thirds or stay home. We're only two-thirds of the way through, and hell is breaking loose.
What? Tell me.
So, we need to talk about the week's big news, VPN filter, which is what the Talos security group of Cisco named. I guess this must be the largest botnet in history. More than 500,000 mostly routers, a few NAS devices, but more than 500,000 routers commandeered into a single botnet, which so freaked out the world that special dispensation was made available to deal with it. But we got to talk about it because it's this is sort of a state-of-the-art, state-sponsored level botnet, which deservedly was in the news. And, you know, like my best buddy a couple days ago said, the FBI says I have to reboot my router. What? And it's like, so we'll explain about that and why they said that and why that isn't enough for our listeners. But that's at the end. We've got lots of other stuff to talk about, of course. The really good news of Oracle's planned end of serialization in Java, which I'll explain. Ghostery's really kind of embarrassing, not even kind of, GDPR faux pas. The emergence of a clever new banking Trojan, which manages to avoid all the things that browsers and AV tools have over the years amassed in order to prevent what it does from doing. Amazon Echo and the case of the fuzzy match. We also have more welcome news from Mozilla. Yet another steganographic hideout.
Steganographic. Just think stegosaurus.
Hideout, a place for the steganographies to hide. an actual real-world appearance, Leo, of the HTTP 418 I'm a teapot error. It actually happened last week.
No.
We also have the hype over Z-Wave's Z-Shave attack, which the press just went ballistic over the idea of more than 100 million IoT devices vulnerable. People can walk through your Z-Wave locked front door, except not so much. And a deep dive into the 500,000 strong VPN filter botnet. So I think lots of fun for our listeners.
Yeah, I really want to hear your story on that one. That's going to be very interesting. It's kind of a fascinating one.
Yeah.
But first, we are Security Now, right? I don't think we've done this ad before. A new sponsor for us, Duo. But I know
you recognize them.
Yeah. Oh, you don't. Oh, I know Duo Security. I've used them for years. I used them for two-factor on LastPass, for instance. It's my favorite two-factor. Duo Security is the leader in they call it zero trust. You know, trust no one? That means zero trust, right? Zero trust, secure access for the enterprise. It simplifies the path to zero trust. Beyond Corp security environment. Duo Beyond allows secure connections to all applications based on the trustworthiness of users and devices. So that means you can set and enforce risk-based adaptive access policies. You can get enhanced visibility into users' devices and activities. You can have mobile users in your enterprise. Better than that, you can embrace mobility and bring your own device, BYOD, make your users happy, and still have frictionless, secure access. Duo Beyond. It grants access to cloud and on-premises apps without clunky VPNs or MDN. I've used it, and it's fantastic. Duo Beyond provides a simple and effective way to adopt a zero-trust security model in your enterprise. For instance, we have to do that here. You know, we use LastPass Enterprise, and we want to use two-factor. Duo Beyond takes it one step beyond. It establishes trust in all users' identities. So if somebody's accessing our passwords, for instance, we know it's them. It verifies the identity of all your users with effective, strong multi-factor authentication before granting access to enterprise applications, to enterprise resources. Nowadays, this becomes more and more important. I really think this is huge. It solves a huge authentication issue. It extends visibility, too, into users' devices and activity. So it goes both ways. They get access, frictionless access, with strong multi-factor authentication to the apps, but you also get visibility into every device used to access corporate applications, even if the device isn't corporate managed. So if they bring an iPhone into the enterprise, you say, all right, you need Duo on it, and now you can keep an eye on who's accessing what when. No need for device management agents. It ensures the trustworthiness of devices. All the devices are inspected by Duo Beyond. So if it's used to access corporate apps or resources, it's going to make sure in real time, at the time of access, to determine its security posture. I love that phrase. And trustworthiness. It enforces risk-based and adaptive access policies. You can protect every application by using Duo Beyond so that you get to define policies that limit access to those users and devices that meet your organization's risk tolerance levels. It enables secure connections to all applications. With Duo Beyond, you not only can grant users access, but you make sure that it's secured access to protected applications, whether it's on-prem or cloud-based, through a uniform, frictionless interface accessible from anywhere. Your users will like it, and you'll have real peace of mind. Now, you're listening to Security Now, so I know you would know what that means, but I want you to tell the boss so that he or she understands Duo Beyond provides zero trust but complete confidence. Adopt a zero-trust security model today with Duo Beyond. All you have to do is visit them at duo.com to learn more. You get a free trial there, duo.com. I don't know if they ask, but if they do, or you're talking to a rep and they say, how do you know about us? Please mention Security Now. Duo.com. Beyond MFA, beyond the perimeter, beyond expectations. It's Duo Beyond. Okay, on with the show, my friend.
So our picture of the week is, it relates to the main topic of the week, VPN filter. It's just, it's a great photo that demonstrates the complexity of the Trojan that we'll be discussing.
This is how it works. This is that diagram, yeah.
Yes, and I mean, it's does some cool stuff. I'll get into it in detail, but for example, after the router is first infected, it reaches out via a URL for a photo at PhotoBucket, and it uses the GPS coordinates where that photo was presumably taken to get the IP address of the what's known as the Stage 2 server, which is what provides the in-RAM component of the Trojan. And then there's a fallback if the photo bucket image, for whatever reason, doesn't provide it with an IP address, then it's able to do more. We'll talk about it at the end of the podcast.
Yeah, I won't ask you the details because I'm curious about this photo bucket thing. This is not steganography. It was simpler than that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All they did was they contrived the GPS address, the GPS coordinates where the picture was supposedly taken in the EXIM data, tagged onto the photo.
Got it.
So it's just sort of a way of it doing something that looks innocuous, but actually wasn't. So anyway, very cool. We've talked actually a lot. One of the recurring memes of this podcast is the danger of interpreters.
We don't make me play the sound effect.
I was just going to say, Leo, I'm sorry.
Danger.
I have a button, you know. I can.
I know you.
Anytime.
I knew you had to be sorely tempted.
You said it. I had. All right. I promise no more. No more.
The interpreters are a recurring problem. I would argue a nightmare when, for example, you can be attacked by a JPEG image. That's an interpreter failure because the JPEG is a structured image which some code reads in order to recreate to decompress the JPEG image. And the clever hackers figure out a way to abuse that interpreter. Well, another one that's been in the news recently because of the Equifax breach and the problems with Apache Struts was Java. And we've talked about the so-called serialization deserialization. It's a mechanism that was stuck into Java back in 1997, back in the early days. And it's very convenient in that it allows a Java object to be stored or sent over the network but through the process known as serialization. That is, it takes a structured, complex thing and turns it into a stream of bytes. Well, at the other end, you need to reconstruct the thing that you essentially deconstructed in order to stream it. And so that's the deserialization. And unfortunately, that's an interpreter. And it turns out that somewhere between one third to maybe as many as one half of Java's historical security problems have arisen from this mechanism, from the serialization deserialization process. As a consequence, Mark Reinhold, who's the chief architect of the Java platform group at Oracle, labeled this whole serialization thing a, quote, horrible mistake, unquote, in the Java language, and has said it's being removed. They're essentially going to replace it with at some future point in Java's life. And, you know, Java's turned out to be a very important implementation technology, you know, that's getting a lot of use in the enterprise because it is a write once, run anywhere technology, because you have it, the so-called JVM, the Java Virtual Machine, which interprets the Java bytecode, which the Java compiler turns Java language into, which then allows you to get lots of portability. So it you know, I mean, there's a place for it. We've run into it on this podcast for a long time. That's finally ended. It only ended when Java stopped being invocable by browsers. And that took like 10 years of disaster before finally it's like, okay, well, I guess we're going to unhook Java from our browsers. Oh, boo-hoo. You know, nobody misses it from the browsers. It you know, just never should have happened, but it did. The good news is it's going away, and with it will come an increase in sort of a belated increase in the Java system's security. Remember
so
that
this is, I hate computer scientists because instead of just saying, oh, it's the ability to interpret bytecode coming from the net,
right?
They call it serialization,
right?
Which just obfuscates its purpose.
Exactly.
Yeah. But computer science is full of these things.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you for explaining. I appreciate it.
And, you know, like reference doc, you know, I'm often reading a lot of research, and you'll like read the beginning of it and it's like, oh, what? And like, sounds like it's a big deal. And then you get into it and you realize they're just using big words. And
yes.
It's like, oh,
yes.
Why did you just say you do added two things and you got the sum instead of
exactly?
Well,
it's a closure. It's you know, it's all about the lexical scoping of the
exactly.
Like, oh, please.
So the good news is it's going away. What they're going to do is they're going to leave behind a plug-in framework so that JSON or XML could be used, which are, you know, as like application-specific, simple serialization for specific needs. So rather than just having it always there and always vulnerable, if somebody needs it, they can just stick in a JSON or an XML plugin to perform that job for them. So, yay, that's like, what is it? It only took, 20, 30 years? Ugh.
Well, I think it's often the case that you write things to be as powerful as possible, and then you discover the malicious applications.
And, you know, I took a lot of heat 12 years ago when I innocently said that the Windows metafile format had an undocumented hook.
Because it's a serializer, isn't it? That's what it does.
It's an interpreter.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you would be stuck with what the interpreter did, except there was one bytecode that said execute what follows as native code. It was like, you know, and even Mark Rusinovich said, yes, I've looked at it. That's what this does.
Yeah.
You know, and
so you could theoretically do the equivalent of another computer science term, sanitizing your inputs to make sure that it doesn't just execute random code off the net.
Yes,
you could write a good serializer, in other words.
Well, and as we've discussed, it's so often the case that this stuff is hard to get working. So the moment you get it working, you're behind schedule.
It's like, done.
Your boss is furious with you.
Ship it.
You haven't seen your friends or even your spouse for, you know, a month or two, and you're not having any fun. You're all hyped up on Coke or Mountain Dew or something. And then when it finally works, it's like, oh, thank God. You know, you just don't, and frankly, that's been sort of one of the advantages I've had with Squirrel is that I didn't have someone
right.
making me ship this right. thing before it was ready.
Right.
And, you know, I was even able to do a, you know, this level of verification throughout it in order to make sure I got this thing cleaned up. So anyway.
Serialization yeah. isn't bad, but allowing code to come in over the net and be executed is what is bad. And,
well,
and that's the thing. It's what you do with the serialization that's the problem.
Well, and you never want stuff to be slow. So
right.
if you put or for example, and you've coded enough, how many times have we seen coding examples where they said, for the sake of clarity,
right.
error checking has been left out
right.
of this.
But yeah, but imagine it's there. Yeah.
What they didn't right. say was, please don't ship it as
right.
is.
Right.
You know, yeah. I mean, and that famous example of the Intel sample
right.
for, was it UPnP, where they, you know, here was like demo code and it ended up just being dropped right into the routers. No.
Yeah.
But that's what they did.
The programming book I'm reading right now says, look, you're going to steal from yourself. Even you're going to copy code. You're going to, because everybody does. So we're going to make it hard for you to do that because it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in other bad ideas, we have ghostery.
Now, you love ghostery.
I do like ghostery. The ghostery itself is not a bad idea. But they sort of screwed up last
Uh-oh.
Week. They thought to celebrate all of their privacy wonderfulness.
Oh, I got this email.
They were going to send out a notice to all of the registered ghosteriers telling them about their the GDPR compliance and how they're holding themselves. In fact, on May 25th, they tweeted, we at Ghostery hold ourselves to a high standard when it comes to users' privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. You go.
Which is what Ghostery was written to do, by the way. It detects plugins on pages.
It's a privacy-enhancing app, you know, web extension, web browser extension. So you're Ghostery, and you've recently also decided to take your previously outsourced email list management in-house in order to carefully manage the privacy of your users and take full responsibility for their care.
Sensible,
and in the wake,
sensible.
Yeah. In the wake of the new GDPR regulations, you decide to send an update email to each of your registered users containing a privacy policy update. Unfortunately, the person who is put in charge of this task is apparently insufficiently familiar with the operation of the shiny new in-house email system. So what is sent out to users against all intention, I'm sure, is email containing, I kid you not, a series of emails, each containing in their to header, stuffed to the brim, 500 email addresses of Ghostery's privately registered user email.
No!
So
I had to not, do it.
Not, so
I had to
not,
do it.
Not the BCC, not the, I mean, you know, not the, it looks like you're the only one that received this and you're just assuming everybody else did. No. You've got the email addresses of 499 other people who maybe in alphabetical order, I didn't see it myself, who Ghostery also sent in that particular block of 500 that single piece of email to. Yikes. So, whoopsie. Of course, Twitter had some fun with this. We have Matt saying, you cannot make this up. the privacy-driven Chrome extension at Ghostery for blocking third-party trackers has done its GDPR mass email exposing all of its users in the email to field. Daniel says, hey, at Ghostery, you sent your privacy policy update email without blind CCing the contacts. Now I'm on an email chain with a whole bunch of randoms replying to your no reply email address. Oh, can you imagine? Oh, reply all.
Do not reply all. Do not reply all, whatever you do.
And then Dan Barker tweets, weird move from at Ghostery. One, accidentally share thousands of email addresses with users in a GDPR email. Two, apologize for doing so on Twitter. Three, delete the apology tweet. Who knows? Anyway, ouch. As they say, stuff happens.
Wow.
And Ghostery stepped in it. So, yikes. Okay, now, this is cool. Well, worrisomely cool. The ESET security guys have found a kind of a diabolical new banking Trojan. And Leo, you're going to get a kick out of this one. Okay, so first of all, banking Trojans are still like at least a third of phishing email are banking Trojans. In recent years, they've been a little endangered because there have been other ways of getting money. Once upon a time, before cryptocurrency, before it occurred to somebody that you could encrypt everyone's files and ransom them, you know, all of these things being generating cash, the sort of the obvious why do you rob the bank question was, oh, let's put Trojans in people's computers that watch them do banking and get their money. So, and we, you know, years ago at the beginning of the podcast, you know, people were, their checking accounts were emptied because they got some stuff on their family shared computer after Junior had his friends come home and stick a floppy drive back then, remember those, in the computer, and, you know, off it went. So we here haven't talked recently a lot about banking Trojans, although their names are well known. Zeus, remember Zeus, also known as ZBot, which also begat Citadel, Atmos, and Flokibot. Then there's NeverQuest, Gozi, Drydex, Ramnet, Gozer, Goznim, Tinba, Gutkim. I mean, and the list just goes on. Because, you know, that's where the money is. And so these things want to get into people's machines. So in their article, in their description of this new, like this, there's been an upsurgence in what ESET calls bank swap as is their Trojan. I'm sorry, back swap. They said banking malware, also referred to as banker, has been decreasing in popularity among cyber crooks for a few years now. One of the reasons being that both anti-malware companies and web browser developers are continuously widening the scope of their protection mechanisms. This is key because this thing has gotten around this against banking Trojan attacks. This results in conventional banking malware fraud becoming more complicated to pull off every day, resulting in malware authors shifting their time and resources into developing easier to make and more profitable types of malware like ransomware, crypto miners, cryptocurrency stealers, and so forth. Again, those are the things we've been talking about recently because they've been a workable working source and arguably easier to perpetrate against today's hardened AV and browsers. So Backswap has taken a new tack, which is, again, is sort of diabolical. It passively monitors the user's activity while watching for banking activity, while watch the user's computer activity, watching for banking activity. Then when it observes some, it uses two tricks to get its own interception code to execute. First of all, this gets into people's computers, piggybacking on some legitimate looking application. It's been seen in SQLmon, DebugView, the WinRAR and Uninstaller, 7-Zip, Ali Debug, the FileZilla server, among other apps. So apps are trojanized and then salted out on the internet, where unwitting users say, "Oh, I want to, you know, I want to uninstall WinRAR," and so they go get it in order to do it. So that allows it to set up shop in the person's machine. What it then does is, now, traditional Trojans have a whole bunch of problems. That is, if they want to get into the browser, which is where online banking happens, yet browsers might be either 32 bits or 64 bits. Well, if you're going to inject some code into the browser's process, you have to know which. And since you don't know which, you got to have both. You need to be able to intercept the non-encrypted content. That is, before it gets encrypted on the way out, or and after it gets decrypted on the way back, in order to like get a shim, to get a hook in there. Well, in the case of the Chromium-based browsers, it is those locations are buried deeply in the browser. They're not easy to find, and they are always changing. So they, of course, change from one browser make to another. Mozilla, Firefox, and Chromium, and IE, none of them have the same architectures. So if you're going to do something that's generally going to be effective, you have to special case each of the browsers, each of the bitnesses, 32 or 64, and every time there's a new version, all of your work gets thrown out and you have to do it again. So when you couple that with the general difficulty of attacking the browser process with the heightened security of browsers.
I'm sorry. That was not me. That wasn't me. It was somebody else.
Along with the heightened pressure against browser processes being interfered with, and third-party AV, which is itself watching all this and trying to protect browsers, the bar has been really elevated. So Backswap comes up with a whole new approach. It bypasses all of this by working with the Windows GUI elements and simulating user input. You can kind of think of it as malicious keystroke macros, which are running on the user's desktop and which are therefore browser agnostic. Doesn't care what kind of browser you have. What it does is it hooks into the Windows accessibility interface on the desktop so that it's able to watch what's going on. It scans the URLs coming and going, and if it sees a pattern match with a bank that it knows how to handle, that it recognizes, it's able to immediately, essentially, jump in and inject JavaScript into the user's browser. How does it do that? It does it by simulating the user keystrokes, by typing them. In the older samples that ESET found, the malware originally inserted the malicious script onto the clipboard and then simulated pressing the key combination for opening the developer's console. Control-Shift-J in Google Chrome, Control-Shift-K in Firefox. Then it would issue a Control-V, which is the Windows key combination for paste, which pastes the contents of the clipboard into the console. Then it would press Enter to execute the JavaScript. It sends all of that so quickly that the user doesn't see it and is able to hide the window, so that the user just sort of experiences a brief pause and doesn't know that anything happened. In later versions of this malware, they've upgraded the approach to take advantage of another feature in all browsers that it's like one of those things where it's like, okay, why do all browsers do this? You know how we have http://https:// You can also have FTP and other things. And in fact, I use SQRL. The squirrel client registers that as a means for the browser to talk to the client in the system. So that's called the URL scheme. Well, browsers are also aware of the JavaScript scheme, JAVASCRIPT:, and you can then put JavaScript after that, which the browser will execute. You stick it in the URL. So, not surprisingly, this backscript banking Trojan is able to type JAVASCRIPT:, into the URL. It first does a control L, which is the universal give the URL the focus. It then types JAVASCRIPT:. And what's interesting is it doesn't paste that, because browsers won't let you paste that. There's an actual prohibition against pasting like a URL containing JavaScript:anything, because they said, that would be a vehicle to attack. Well, yes, it turns out that, however, they cannot discriminate between the malware typing it in manually and the user typing it in manually, because in terms of the Windows message loop, which is the way all this is done, it looks the same. And it's just like a keystroke macro that would be entering it. So it types JAVASCRIPT, then enters the long JavaScript blob, basically the entire JavaScript injection into the URL, hits enter, and then blanks the URL as if nothing wrong had happened, and is able thereby to inject its own JavaScript into the user's browser. And this is now jumped onto the scene and is back in the game, essentially browser agnostic, doesn't care about bitness, performs no in-process injection, AV doesn't know how to block it, and browsers aren't blocking it, and this thing has just taken off and is doing a gangbuster business as a banking Trojan. So, we see where there's a will, there's a way, and some very clever people behind BackSwap have figured out a means of getting past all of our AV. So the takeaway for our users, our listeners, is don't get yourself infected with this thing.
Okay. Basically, thanks for the tip. I'll do my best.
If you do, you're probably in trouble. I would argue that because banking Trojans are still a thing, it's easy to get phished. It's easy to get yourself hooked by one. With computers being as inexpensive as they are now, maybe, and if you're someone who does a lot of online banking, if there's a possibility that you've got a lot of money sitting in account and you're doing funds transfers, take an older laptop or an older machine and just stick Debian Linux on it. It costs nothing.
Yeah.
It's free. It comes with Firefox installed. And just don't use it for anything else. Let that be your, you know, the machine where all you do is your banking. It boots pretty quickly. I think it's a great solution.
You don't use email on it, though, because you could, in theory, still be phished.
That's true. Exactly. You just banking.
Yeah.
So that requires some self-control, but probably worthwhile.
I know a lot of people now using Chromebooks for banking, and I think that's equally secure.
I agree.
Secure.
That's a great solution.
Yeah. Cheap. You could buy, you know, a couple $100 Chromebook and just keep it for the stuff you need to be secure.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It's interesting, too. As I was reading this, I was thinking, oh, well, that's nice. One of the things that I also did in the Squirrel client, as our listeners will all be seeing soon, is I use a secondary darkened Windows desktop, much like the UAC. The UAC in Windows is much more than just a visual effect. It's actually a second desktop which is invoked, which is secure. And so that prevents keystroke loggers and keystroke inserters and so forth from getting literally their hooks into it. And it's funny because when I initially implemented this because I wanted the Squirrel authentication prompt not to be spoofable. That is, I didn't want a web page to be able to pop up a dialogue that looked exactly like the prompt for logging into Squirrel, because a lot of users would go, oh, like when they were logging in with Squirrel, they would expect that. And so I needed to do something that a browser could not spoof. And switching to a secure desktop, I monochrome it and darken it in order to make it look very distinctive, because no code in a browser is able to mess with the exterior of the browser. So in the process, a side effect of that is that keystroke loggers that might be monitoring what you're doing get disconnected. So it's just another benefit of sort of the belt and suspenders approach. And I think, Leo, we should take our second break, and then we will continue looking at the case of the Amazon Echo and the case of the fuzzy match.
Okay. Fuzzy matching. Next on Security Now. If you're in IT, this sound may be – I was queuing this up earlier. I'm sorry to interrupt you. This sound may be familiar. This is a – when we were in Japan, I wanted to record this, but fortunately there's a YouTube video. I don't have to. This is the sound of a pachinko parlor. 1,000 things going on at the same time. And that's what it's like in IT. If you've got all the alerts on and they're going off nonstop, your life could sound, instead of like that, your life could sound a little bit more like this. Peaceful, calm, relaxing, with Moogsoft. Moogsoft is a way to take all those alerts and tickets that light up your monitor like a Christmas tree and make it calm, like you're by the lake and relaxed. Everything's pleasant. So that's your choice, pachinko parlor or Zen garden. With Moogsoft, choose the Zen garden, because, you know, if you're stressed out, you're just not being productive. You can't analyze all those tickets that are flooding in, all those notifications. But you do need some, right? It's not like you could just turn off notifications, but then the server would burn to the ground and you'd be out of a job. So Moogsoft AI Ops. AI stands for Algorithmic IT Operations, and it reduces your IT alerts and tickets by 99%. Guaranteed. Your life could be calm and peaceful like this. It works with all your existing IT tools, so all of those alerts, all those notification tools, all of them are still operational. We use Panopta, for instance. It's still working, but the patented technology correlates all those events into something they call situations, actionable work items. And you get one ping instead of 1,000, and it's something you can do something about right now, so you can focus on tackling the stuff that matters. And if you need an example, Just look at the dry ice platform from HCL Technologies. They're a global IT managed service provider. You can imagine, you know, a managed service provider means you have many clients, all of whom have their own alerts and noises and sounds. They use MoogSoft AI Ops as the event management layer in their dry ice platform. That means clients can streamline operational workflows, reduce time in the detect-to-correct lifecycle of incident tickets. They've actually seen a 33% reduction in mean time to restore. That's a third. It means they can support more customers with service quality while keeping operational costs low, efficiency high. And by the way, it's good for the soul. You'll feel better. You'll be more effective with MoogSoft AI Ops. Reduce your IT alerts and tickets by up to 99% right now. Visit MoogSoft.com and get a demo. MoogSoft, MoogSoft.com. See the cow? It's Moo, like a cow. But then he likes synthesizers, too. So it's MoogSoft.com. And get a demo. MoogSoft.com. We thank them so much for their support and for making life more peaceful here in Lake Titicaca.
I guess the cow head does indicate, I mean, it makes it very clear it's supposed to be Moo.
He tried, so I talked to the founder. He tried to get Moo.com, because he likes cows, I guess. But there wasn't available. But he also liked the Moog synthesizer. So he said, what if we put cows and software synthesizers together, we'd get MoogSoft. Nice. And he could get that one. A lot of company names come from the fact that they can't get the domain, the URL, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So, Amazon Echo and the case of the fuzzy match. This initially seems scary, but Amazon explains it. And I would argue, within the bounds of what we want, they were not at fault. KIRO, which is the Channel 7 ABC affiliate in Seattle, carried a story last week about a misbehaving Amazon Echo device. A family in Portland contacted Amazon to investigate after they said a private conversation in their home was recorded by Amazon's Echo, and that the recorded audio was sent to the phone of a random person in Seattle who happened to be on the family's contact list. The wife of the family, Danielle, who did not want her last name revealed, said, KIRO reporting of this, my husband and I would joke and say, I bet these devices were listening to what we're saying. And they were big Echo users. Every room in their home was wired with Amazon devices to control heat, lighting, and security. But Danielle said 2 weeks ago, their love for the Echo changed. And I would argue, well, I will explain how this happened in a second. With an alarming phone call, the person on the other at the other end of the call said, unplug your Echo devices right now. You're being hacked. That was not true, but you could understand why they might think so. That person was one of her husband's employees calling from nearby Seattle. So she says, we unplugged all of them, and he proceeded to tell us that he'd received audio files of recordings from inside our house. She said, at first, my husband was like, no, you didn't. And the recipient of the message said, then explained that you sat there talking about hardwood floors. And so they realized, oh, yes, we were just talking about hardwood floors. You did hear us. So she listened to the conversation, which was then sent back to her. And in this reporting said that she couldn't believe that someone, you know, nearly 200 miles away had also heard their conversation. Yeah, well, welcome to the world of technology. Okay, so they got a hold of Amazon, took them a while to get to an engineer who finally said that that the Amazon engineers went through the logs and they saw exactly what had been described and apologized. She said that the engineer apologized like 15 times in a matter of half an hour, said that they really appreciated it being brought to their attention and that that was something that, that they needed to fix. Although Danielle said that the engineer did not provide any specifics about why it happened and, for example, whether it's a widespread issue. Okay, so in their KIRO, using the strength of their being a network affiliate, did get through to Amazon and got some answers. They spoke to someone, Shelby Licklider at Amazon, who sent them the following statement. The Echo woke due to a word in the background conversation sounding like the trigger word, which I won't repeat. We all know. Then the subsequent conversation was heard as a send message request, at which point the Echo said out loud, to whom? At which point the background conversation was interpreted as a name in the customer's contact list. The device then asked out loud, repeated the contact name and said, right? And the Echo then interpreted the background conversation as right. And as unlikely as this string of events is, said the spokesman, the spokeswoman from Amazon, that's what occurred. And she said, we are evaluating options to make this case even less likely. So, as I said, Amazon Echo and the case of the fuzzy match. This is inherent in a voice-controlled system where you want to do everything by voice and you are doing fuzzy matching. And it's, to my mind, entirely feasible and reasonable that there could have been a conversation in a home where every room has one of these devices. And if you don't have at some point something that says for a high security action, and you know, this isn't particularly high security. If you want to voice enable sending something that you say to somebody on your contact list, and there's that, and that's an interactive interchange with confirmation checkpoints by the device, and the confirmations are also audio, and at no point do you have to touch it or push a button or do anything else. There's going to be some percentage of time in the universe of these devices, always on, always available, always listening, you know, like wanting to reliably catch their trigger phrase and not frustrate their users. You know, it's a balancing act. And so it's entirely reasonable with, you know, if you want this much convenience that you're going to, you know, I mean, these people were freaked out and it's like, well, yes, but you know, you have Echo enabled your whole home and you're somehow missing the confirmation audio prompts, and that can happen. So there was, you know, this got picked up by the press is like, oh my God, another, you know, like, you know, Amazon Echo spying thing. And it's like, no, you have, you know, we talk about on this podcast, one of our other memes is the security versus convenience trade-off. And it's hugely convenient to be able to use your voice to order things to happen. But, you know, you might get an unasked for package of toilet paper at your front door from time to time.
It's a highly unlikely coincidence of things. And I think they could do some things to improve it. For one thing, it sends those messages off without confirmation. And, you know, Siri and everybody else will say, oh, is this the message you wish to send? And ask for confirmation. And I think that that's a simple thing Amazon will almost certainly do to the Echo to prevent these kinds of things. But, yeah, we've all heard the Echo respond to TV or Google
yes.
Home. Or
it suddenly
or,
lights up, yeah. in the light, especially loud television. It's like looking right. around saying, what? What? Me?
You're talking to me? I have I have a Home, a Siri-based HomePod, a Google Home, and an Amazon Echo in my kitchen. And not a day goes by without them interacting. And we just get used to it. Yeah. We just get used. It's like you hear her mumbling in the corner. We go, oh, yeah, whatever. It was happened this morning. And I didn't even know what she was talking about. It's just like your crazy aunt over there in the corner. Just,
remember, I think it was on the Jetsons. It was Rosie the Robot.
Yeah, Rosie the Robot.
Yeah. So she's just sort of running around.
Under her breath.
just sort of, you know, like rolling around dusting stuff. And I was like, okay, Rosie.
So anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, I just sort of wanted to say that, yes, it doesn't have to be hacked. It doesn't have to be malware. It just can be voice control where some percentage of the – I mean, there's a non-zero probability that the device could interpret a – I mean, any length. I mean, yes, as the interaction is more – is like more back and forth, the probability of it happening is going to go down. But – if you're not at any point requiring the person to press a button to confirm something, you know, to like physically take an action, if it's all 100% voice, then there's a percentage of misfire that will happen. And yep. So you have to sort of have that, understand the trade-off of convenience versus security.
And when Echo talks to you, listen, because she's trying to do something.
Yes.
See what she's trying to do.
Bad Echo.
No.
So we're currently at Firefox 60, and it remains my go-to browser, mostly just because of tabs. I have all the tabs I want, and I want a lot of tabs, and Chrome refuses to deal with that. So fine. Until they come up with a way of giving me more tabs, I'm sticking with Firefox. And the good news is Firefox is keeping up. With 63, and we're at 6.0 now, so three versions from now when that hits mainstream, they're adding a number of new features. And I still like my term malmining, which to me is just much clearer than crypto jacking. We got so many crypto this and crypto that it just doesn't stand out. Crypto jacking doesn't feel like cryptocurrency mining hijacking, which is what it is. Malmining, yes. Anyway, the good news is Firefox 63 can block that. Okay, so what they've done is they're sort of overloading this category known as tracking protection. They're throwing all kinds of other stuff in there. They probably ought to just not say, oh, stop calling it tracking protection, because if it's also blocking crypto mining and fingerprinting, well, I guess fingerprinting is tracking, but certainly crypto mining is not. Okay, so just to back up a little bit, remember that they right now, Firefox private browsing mode has tracking protection on by default, but normal browsing doesn't. Yet, it's now recommended for people who want increased privacy and significantly performance that you go under Tools, Options, Privacy, and Security, and under tracking protection, switch it to Always. What you get then, even when you're not using private browsing, is significantly, noticeably higher performance, because unfortunately, pages are just loading so much crap from third-party servers where they've got to do DNS lookups and go get the stuff and download it, that it really does slow down our pages. So just saying, no, thank you, don't want that stuff, it makes your pages run a lot snappier. What is being added under tracking protection is granular control over analytics, advertising, fingerprinting, crypto mining, and social media stuff. And for each of those five categories, you can say you always want it, you only want it in private windows, or you never want it. So they're breaking it apart, giving you granular control, and happily going to somehow, probably using some browser heuristics, look at a tab which is apparently doing mining. I mean, maybe they'll track miners on the fly, or they'll just do it behavior based. But you'll be able to say, no, thank you, and not do that. Oh, and significantly, there are also per site exceptions. So if there's a site, for example, if say that crypto mining to support the site you're visiting actually catches on someday, well, the site might say, you know, you're blocking our ads and you're blocking our crypto mining. We'd like you to support us. So either turn on ads or turn on mining. So while you're here, we can mine some cryptocurrency in the background. So if you decide that seems reasonable, you'll be able to do that. Also, they're unburying this somewhat. You'll be able to get to it from that menu in the upper right-hand corner of Firefox. So quicker and easier access to tracking protection. In the future, also with 63, they will be adding the ability to wash the content that a site gives you, cookies and other content loaded into your browser on behalf of that site in the little lock icon. So you'll also be able to clean that up. And they're adding one-time password support, you know, Authy-style one-time password, time-based one-time passwords to the Mozilla account preferences. And so that'll just be appearing in coming weeks. So Firefox is still in the game, and I'm glad. I mentioned the tongue twister steganographic, steganography, and so forth. Steganography, we've talked about from time to time, and I've sort of said, it doesn't excite me that much. It's the act of hiding in plain sight. And so in our digital era, where we've got crazy resolution of things, it's just not that difficult to do. And I guess that's why it doesn't get me all worked up. For example, if you've got a beautiful photo, where you've got 32-bit color depth, you've got high resolution representation of each of R, G, and B color. Our eye cannot see the least significant bits. That is, if a color, which ranges from 0 to 255, if it's 167, if one pixel is 168 or 166, well, that is like plus or minus one on either side, we can't see it. But it would be possible to take the entire image's least significant bits and hide a message there. So you've essentially built a message into an image where the bandwidth is relatively low. That is, you have a large image and a message which is a fraction of the image size, but it doesn't require any particular trickery. So in a sense you've hidden it in the image, and only if someone knew where to go to get it would they be able to find it. It's a little bit like we were talking about the VPN filter bot, which hides the IP address of the server in the GPS coordinates of a photo where the photo was supposed to have been taken. It's like, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, some researchers at Columbia came up with yet another place to hide data. And that is in the shapes, the detailed distortions of the shapes of font characters in a font. I avoided the word glyph, but that's the technical term. Font glyphs are these individual character instances. And boy, I've got the links in the show notes for anyone who is interested. The science that they applied to inserting and distracting data from slight perturbations in font glyph shape is impressive. As I've said, I'm just sort of not that impressed in general with steganography. It's like, yeah, okay, I guess that's kind of cool. I would argue these guys took it all the way to the where, and they give an example of some text printed on a poster where they had encoded a relatively low bandwidth message into tiny, non-visualizable distortion, so that you could stare at it and you don't see any difference. But their technology, given 200 pixels per inch resolution, is able to, from a photo of this chunk of text printed on a poster, is able to recreate the original image that was encoded into tiny distortions in the text. So, I wanted to put it on everyone's radar just as another place that you could hide data. And if you're curious about the details, it's an amazing piece of research. But it's like, yeah, okay. It also occurred to me when I was thinking about this, where else could you hide information? You could, in our digital era, you could use tiny distortions in the frequency of notes in a song. Just detune notes a little bit sharp or a little bit flat, or just skew their frequency a little bit off beat. There's so many ways that you could distort something such that if you knew to look for it, you would know that was non-random, and then you could extract a message. But it's sort of, I don't know, it's like it's so possible to do, it's so easy that it's, except that these guys really applied some serious technology and math to it. Other than that, still, it was very impressive.
Wait a minute, say that again so I can record it and put it on one of my buttons.
Other than that, okay, so we've actually had, Leo, a real-world occurrence of HTTP error 418, I'm a teapot.
How can I do that?
Now,
can I make it happen here?
to remind our listeners, it was April 1st, not surprisingly, of 1998, when RFC, and Leo, you probably want to look this up, RFC 2324. So it's an official IETF.org document, RFC 2324. It is the HTCPCP protocol, which is the Hypertext Coffee Pot Control Protocol. And we're all familiar with the infamous HTTP 404. That's the page not found. You don't normally see the 300s, like a 301 or a 302, because those are the redirects. That's where, and you don't see them because your browser normally does them for you. You click on a link to content that is moved somewhere else, and what you get back is a 301 redirect, which then your browser sees and goes, oh, that content is over at this URL, and you go there instead. Well,
this introduces the brew method. You've got posts, of course, but this is brew.
Yes, and in fact, the RFC begins under rationale and scope. It explains very seriously there is coffee all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, in a world in which computing is ubiquitous, the computists want to make coffee.
There's also a when method. So when you're adding milk, you can say when.
Oh, it Lord. Says, coffee brewing is an art, but the distributed intelligence of the web-connected world transcends art. Thus, there is a strong, dark, rich requirement for a protocol designed espressoly for the brewing of coffee. Coffee is brewed using coffee pots. Networked coffee pots require a control protocol if they are to be controlled naturally. So, the hypertext coffee pot control protocol, which you have been exploring, Leo,
yes,
in the RFC.
Beautifully written.
2324, dated April 1st, 1998.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So what happened? For 7 hours yesterday, many developers using NPM, I'm not kidding, the Node.js Package Manager.
Yes, I use it all the
JavaScript,
time. Yes, yes.
Were receiving an error message. Error 418, I'm a teapot. The trouble was seen by those teams operating behind a proxy that was appending the port specifier :443 to the domain name on its way across the proxy out onto the public internet.
Well, that's SSL, isn't it? That's
But it was confusing the NPM registry's servers, which resulted in them returning an error 418, I'm a teapot declaration. Yep. Somewhere, someone decided to return that error for unforeseen conditions.
I love it.
And it actually did happen in the real world. So
great.
Yes, I'm a teapot lives well past 1998.
That's so awesome.
Okay, so this is one of those where the press is hyperventilating. And I meant to grab the headline from Forbes, because I saw that even Forbes picked it up with a breathless, you know, oh my God, 100 million IoT devices potentially exposed. And I'm sure you'll be talking about it tomorrow on This Week in Google with Stacy, since she's the IoT goddess of the network. So this is the Z-Shave attack against Z-Wave IoT devices. Z-Wave is the protocol, the technology, which appears to be winning. It has about 100-meter range, so it's much greater range than Bluetooth, which is one of its advantages. And they finally got security right. The bad news is they didn't get it right in the beginning. And so they are... It is true. I mean, what was found by these guys at Pentest Partners is true, but it's not as bad as people would think. You know, the headlines were Z-Shave attack could impact 100 million IoT devices. Z-Wave downgrade attack left over 100 million IoT devices open to attackers. Z-Shave lets you open Z-Wave-based locks.
See, that would be bad if you were using it to lock your front door.
That would be bad.
Yeah.
And so here's how I would characterize this. Yes, a determined attacker who was also patient and who installed a battery-powered eavesdropping thing might be able to obtain the household's secret encryption key, after which it, yes, would have the ability to unlock the doors. So it's not good. I mean, it's not
perfect. How long is the key? Is it six digits?
No. So here's the background. When we did talk about all of this some time ago, so if any of our listeners don't remember us doing a podcast on Z-Wave, because we did earlier on, because of this, because of the compromise in its security, it didn't occur to me to go back and get the Security Now number, the podcast where we delved into this in great detail. But here's the deal: you can have with Z-Wave no encryption security, and okay, that's bad.
I'll grant you that's bad.
You do not want that unless, you know, I mean maybe you, for, you know, you've got an old hub that doesn't support encryption. Well, okay, don't hook up a door lock or a security system to an unencrypted Z-Wave. That's bad. Or you could have S0 level encryption, which is not bad, but not perfect. Or you can have S2 level encryption, which is perfect. Huh. I mean, and I don't use that word loosely. No one's ever heard me say that. I mean, it's really, 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 really good. If either S0 or S2 security is in place in the environments, in the home, then an encrypted key is known to all Z-Wave devices, and all communications is securely encrypted under that secret key. So the Z-Wave network, the way it works is it's got a secret. And pairing a new device is the process of informing that device of the household's secret. S0 encryption used an all zeros initial key, and that was its weakness. If it used all zeros, then a passive eavesdropper who could capture any pairing of a Z-Wave device could capture the traffic, know that they were using a all zeros key to communicate the actual, that is to encrypt the actual home's secret, and then decrypt it themselves and be on the network. Okay, so that's the weakness of S0. It is encrypted, but the pairing event creates a vulnerability that is significant. As a consequence, S0 has been completely deprecated. In fact, the Silicon Labs that are the owners of Z-Wave have loudly stated that, like, as of a year ago, no newly certified Z-Wave devices can have anything but S2. Yet some 48 plus devices, as I recall, did receive certification with S0 after that deadline. So, whoops. The problem is, and we understand this, we've seen this over and over again, it is very difficult to move something that is working from it's good enough to it's really good security. Okay, but now here's the problem. S2 exists. Everyone knows how it works. It uses elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman key exchange, thus perfect as far as we know. Diffie-Hellman is fabulous. Notwithstanding the fact that that's what Squirrel uses to do its crypto in several places. The idea is that with S2 Z-Wave security, each of the devices in the pairing situation, rather than this transient use of an all zeros key to encrypt the actual key, which really isn't, you know, why bother? If anyone's going to listen, then they're going to be able to get in under S0. After that, the network is encrypted, so that's certainly good. With S2, each of the two devices to be paired creates a nonce, a random chunk of nonsense, and sends it to the other. The magic of Diffie-Hellman key agreement means that each end can obtain a secret in common, which even somebody listening in and seeing those that exchange occur, capturing all the traffic, cannot figure out what key it is that they each have. And that's what's so cool about this. So under S2 security, they each come up with a random number, they share a version of that with each other, and that allows them to independently arrive at a shared secret, which the hub then uses to encrypt the household key, which it sends to the device being brought onto the network, since it has that ephemeral key that it got through Diffie-Hellman key exchange. It uses that to decrypt, and now it's on the network. Perfect security. I mean, just, it doesn't get any better than that. Now here's where the attack comes in. It turns out there is, because of the legacy, even if, well, first of all, obviously, both ends have to support S2. If either end is only S0 aware, then you have what we've seen before, a protocol security downgrade. That is, the more secure is forced to drop down to the level of the lesser secure in order to reach a protocol they both understand. So the problem is that S0 devices are still predominant. And in fact, S0 hubs are still the majority. Even Samsung's very popular Z-Wave hub is still S0 security, despite the fact that S2 is what we want to be using. So again, this is another thing that we see over and over, is even after security is figured out and made strong enough, everybody's got to play. Okay, well, the fact that you have to support the security of the lesser end, that opens you to a real-time downgrade through active interference. And that's what the guys at Pentest Partners did that got them some headlines. And I would argue, okay, yes, it's true. If at the moment of two S2 devices pairing, you shot out a little bit of active noise. Now you can't be passive anymore. You've got to actively interfere with the communications in RF spectrum between the devices in order to intercept and force them to believe that each other is S0. So it's high speed. They couldn't even pull it off without generating some custom tools that could respond quickly enough. So it's sort of even still theoretical, although they were able to demonstrate it in one class of this attack. So again, it's a bit of a tempest in a teapot. It's just not a huge problem. The vulnerability exists briefly. It requires a very sophisticated attacker to be interfering with the radio communications during the brief interval of interchange between the two devices. So I don't think there's anything to worry about here. It's unfortunate that Z-Wave ever offered no security or S0, because it's going to just take a while for everything to get up to S2 and all the S0 devices to finally leave the ecosystem. Eventually they will. And then we've got a good system with very robust security. Okay. And one last final bit. I got a very nice note from the Netherlands from someone who just said his name was Wouter, W-O-U-T-E-R. He gave me permission to pronounce it Walter, but he also told me how to pronounce it. So it's Wouter. He says, "Hi, Steve and Leo. Thanks for talking about the difference between broken hard drive sectors and failing hard drives. If the described problems and errors do not indicate a failing hard drive, what does?" That's actually a really good point. And he says, "I once read a general recommendation to replace spinning hard drives every 3 years, but that sounds pretty costly. I do have some older hard drives for use in Time Machine backups. Should I worry? Some general information on A, how to spot failing hard drives, and B, when to replace a hard drive would be greatly appreciated. Regards, Wouter." And we've talked about this sort of – we've skated around this a number of times. As I mentioned recently, it is quite possible for sectors to be failing in the normal course of a drive's use. That's why drives have spare sectors, is because they may be needed. They're expected to be needed. And the drive won't start complaining until it starts running out of spare sectors. So it expects that defects will arise over time, and then they're called grown defects. That's a term of art in hard drives, grown defects. Defects grow. The sectors that acquire those defects need to be taken out of service and spares put in. So one way that a drive could start getting in trouble, if it notices that its spares pool is drying up, that's not good. That will be reflected in the smart data as a drive health problem. But you need to know to look at the smart data. The other really more sensitive way to tell is the dynamic rate of error correction. That is, and this is something that is really doesn't get enough attention, and it's one of the coolest things about what SpinRite is able to do. If a drive is just sitting there doing nothing, that is not working at a given workload, then it's not needing to do correction, and so none of the metrics that SMART shows have any meaning. But if you put it under load, as SpinRite does, then suddenly the rate at which errors are having to be corrected is a beautifully sensitive analogs meter of the health of the drive. When you get the drive new, run SpinRite on it and look at the smart data. One of the screens in SpinRite is a smart data monitor screen. It will show you the rate of error corrections in corrections per megabyte of data transfer, data read. And you can make a note of that. And from time to time, when you run the drive, take a look at that and see that it sort of remains constant. If at some point you see a spike in that, well before the drive has collapsed on you, has failed, that rate will increase. And that's the key to say, okay, that's an actual valid indication that the drive is having to work too hard in order to recover data. It probably means that it's consuming its spares pool much more quickly, and you'll be in trouble soon. So there is an indication. If you just Google SpinRite space smart, S-M-A-R-T, the first link that Google shows is a link to the page at GRC that takes that smart data screen, the smart data monitor screen, apart and shows you what all the different meters and metrics and things are. It's kind of cool. Take a look at it. Just Google SpinRite space smart, and you'll see what I mean.
Nice.
And Leo, our last break, and then we're going to dive into VPN filter. a really interesting event in the industry this past week.
I wanted to show you something I thought was really cool. I know you'll kind of, you know, get it. It's kind of video, though, so I apologize for people listening. Earlier today, there was a BGP misrouting. I know you, I'm sure you read about it.
Border Gateway Protocol.
Quad ones was accidentally hijacked by a Chinese ISP. Quickly fixed, so not a big deal. But Cloudflare has, I think, the coolest thing ever, which is an animated replay of the event. And you can watch the routers, the BGP routers, get hijacked and then reassemble. It's really actually, I mean, you would understand what's going on here better than I do. But it's just kind of fun to watch as the routers, you know, go, wait a minute, what happened here? And then figure it all out. It's really
right.
Neat. Yeah. It's Cloudflare's replay is just...
Yeah, the idea, of course, is that routers advertise the routes that they're responsible for. And, you know, quite non-maliciously, I mean, without any malicious intent, it does happen from time to time, a router can declare that it has a much shorter path to a network than it actually does. And so it advertises this short route, and all the routers it's connected to go, cool. And they send their traffic there instead of going the long way, which unfortunately was the right way.
Yeah, it was fixed later in the day, but it was not even for that long. And I don't think it was malicious. I think they just were using 1.1.1.0/24 as a test route, which then Hurricane Electric propagated to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Thank you, Hurricane. But it's fun. This is so cool. I never knew they had this tool. So to watch these at work is really neat. Really neat. Little JavaScript animation there. Cool. Our show today brought to you by Capital One, talking about security. Let's talk about a great way to use a credit card online. I know sometimes people are a little nervous about using their credit cards online, but I have to say, this is the solution. This is the solution. Stop sharing your real credit card number when you shop online. Start using a virtual number from Capital One's Eno. Eno is its intelligent assistant, E-N-O. And what Eno does, I have the Eno plugin on my Chrome browser. They're extending it to other browsers or working on that, but right now it's on Chrome. When you go to a site with a credit card form, Eno pops up saying, I'd be glad to generate a virtual number for you that's merchant specific, that's tied to your credit number, but the merchant doesn't get that. They just get a token. It even generates an expiration date 5 years from the date that you're using it. It is just awesome. You can turn those numbers on and off. You have total control of them, so you're always in control of how you pay online. It does map back to your physical credit card, but it works great in two conditions. One, if the merchant's compromised or you no longer trust them, you just lock or delete the virtual number. They no longer have access. But to me, the biggest use is going to be, and it's happened to me many times before, when my credit card number, if I lose my credit card and I cancel it or I get a new number, then I have to go to every site I've ever used that number for and change it. With these virtual numbers, no matter what happens, if your card's lost or stolen, the virtual numbers keep working so that your online subscriptions and your recurring payments just keep humming along without interruption. Tom Poole, who's the guy behind all this, senior VP of digital e-commerce at Capital One, he calls it the dreaded reset moment.
When we looked at this and realized that the most pressing problems our customers were facing was this giant reset moment, whether the card expires or it's lost or stolen or it's compromised online, this moment when suddenly out of the blue you were being asked to spend a couple hours updating your numbers on every single site. It's terrible.
It is.
People live in fear of it, so much so that they actually steer their shopping toward a handful of sites that they trust and avoid trialing new experiences and new products precisely because they're afraid that it's a game of Russian roulette. If they put their number at one more site, that might be the site that triggers the event that is the real pain in the neck for everybody.
Credit cards are insanely useful. You shouldn't have to limit it to sites you trust or not use it at all. That's why if you have an existing Capital One credit card, you can just download and install the browser extension from the Chrome Web Store. Somebody in the chat room says he's been using the Firefox extension for a couple of weeks. So here's what you do to see if it'll work with your browser. Go to CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. Shop safer without all the hassle. Eno's got your back. Virtual Numbers is brilliant from Capital One. And it's a really, the implementation is sweet. It really is. You got to try it. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. And we thank Capital One for their support. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. Steve Gibson is not virtual. He's the real deal.
So, unfortunately, so is this botnet. So last week, we had an evolving story regarding concerns surrounding a massive botnet of more than 500,000 routers. Yes, more than 500,000 routers commandeered into a single botnet. For anyone who's interested, the Talos Intelligence Group of Cisco did beautiful coverage of this. I've got the link in the show notes. And this is one of those situations where the answer to the question is, what could it do? Is a chilling anything it wants? I mean, it's if you've got 500,000 routers connected to the internet, that's bad. I mean, when they're under control of a malicious entity, actually any entity, because I mean, you could even make a mistake like the Border Gateway Protocol routing mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
Forensics evidence strongly implicated Russia as the botnet's creator, and it's believed to be intended as a network for attacking Ukraine. Cisco found more than 500,000 instances of this VPN filter malware on routers manufactured by, and this is what's important for our listeners because there's a takeaway here, some of these are not old junky routers that no one has. I ran across a note, for example, there was a D-Link something or other DL620 router that had a back door that was discovered, except that it's really, really old and they don't support it anymore and five people have them. So I was like, okay, I'm not even going to bother talking about that. These routers are mainstream routers. So Linksys, Microtik, Netgear, TP-Link, and also some QNAP NAS devices. The Linksys E1200 and the E2500, as well as the Linksys WRVS4400N. Three routers from Microtik. Did we decide it was Microtik or Microtik? Microtik.
Because Microtik sounds like really, necrotic. That's not a
yes,
good...
Exactly. No. Yeah. Three Microtik routers, the 1016, 1036, and 1072. A bunch of Netgear routers, the DGN2200, the Netgear R6400, the R7000, the R8000, the WNR1000, and the WNR2000. And then QNAP devices, the TS251, the TS439 Pro, and other QNAP NAS devices running the QTS software. And finally, the TP-Link R600 VPN. If you have any of those routers, you need to pay attention. Because those routers are the routers that were hosting more than 500,000 instances of this VPN filter malware. It is highly sophisticated, complex botnet with a bunch of moving parts and a plug-in architecture. We talked about earlier this month the hide-and-seek botnet as the first botnet that had been seen to survive reboots. Well, this is the second one. So VPN filter can survive a reboot of the router because it's able to install sort of a little stub of itself, which Cisco calls stage one, into the router's flash memory. So there are now two pieces of malware, hide and seek that we talked about earlier this month, and VPN filter, able to statically infiltrate and remain in a router. So the takeaway is what has been recommended is that the certainly that you reboot your device. I'll explain what that does and doesn't do in a minute. But it's only by performing a factory reset back to the original device settings that we're told that flushes the malware out of the device. I'm not sure why that's true. So I think checking for any firmware updates and using this as a good time, a very good time, to update your router firmware makes a lot of sense. So if you're on that list of routers, see if there's an update, and I would reflash my router if you're concerned with the latest firmware, even if it's the one you've already got, if your router will allow it to be reflashed with the same firmware. It might say, oh, I've already got the latest one, go away. Don't know.
So rewriting the firmware eliminates the stub that's reloading the malware.
Yes.
But given that they've got the command and control servers, I guess reloading the malware is not going to happen anyway, right?
Yeah, actually it does.
Oh, it does?
It's a little more complicated.
The FBI's advice is wrong.
It's not complete. Okay, so here's the deal. Cisco breaks this thing down into three stages, stage one, stage two, stage three. Stage one, we've talked about. That's the thing that goes persistent by modifying the flash and getting itself rerunning whenever you start the router. When that starts up, what we were talking about at the top of the podcast occurs. It first tries to go out to the photo sharing site and grab a photo from a URL and then know that the GPS pseudo coordinates are actually the IP address of the command and control server. If that fails for any reason, then its backup plan is to do the same thing, pull a photo from a well-known domain. And that domain is toknowall.com, toknowall.com. So from either of those instances, the stage one is able to obtain a larger RAM resident stage two. And this is clever because that means that you're making the footprint in flash is very small, which means it's going to be able to find a home in many more routers. If you had to load the whole blob of malware into flash for persistence, there's much more chance that the file system that might not have much empty space wouldn't be able to accommodate it. So these guys said, aha, we're going to create a tiny little stub and then we'll get the rest on the fly. That part lives in RAM. Okay, so that part does something else. And stage two sets up a plug-in architecture, which stage three are the plugins for. But the other thing that didn't get mentioned by the FBI is that stage one, the resident portion, also opens a listening port. So if if the botnet authors had obtained a list of IP addresses that had been contacting the command and control server, then they're able to spray all of those IP addresses with new command and control stuff and maybe take it back. So it seemed, as you think about this, this thing is so sophisticated and so nicely designed that you would expect there to be some means of recovering command and control once that what's there has been reverse engineered and the command and control servers have been taken down. And in fact, that recovery system exists. So that's why, Okay, so the reason the FBI wants people to reboot is twofold. First of all, it is true that after having taken down the main command and control servers, what happened was later last week they got a court order from a judge that allowed them to compel VeriSign, who I'm sure was quite happy to, but VeriSign said, please compel us to hand over domain control for the toknowall.com domain. The FBI pointed that domain to their own servers, and then the botnet, this half a million plus strong botnet, began pinging their server. So now that allows the FBI to themselves obtain the IP addresses of all of these compromised routers. And since they're not going to do anything nefarious with it, if users now reboot, a couple things happen. In the reboot process, the stage one does its outreach to these domains. In the process of doing that, the FBI will get an updated, fresh list of all the IPs of the routers which are compromised. And since stage one will not be able to obtain the stage two malware from either the photo sharing site or toknowall.com, it doesn't go any further. But the listening port is still open. Now, the other thing I didn't talk about that stage two does, aside from creating a plugin framework, which allows some powerful plugins to be installed, and this is one of the things that really upset people, there is flash wiping capability in the stage two payload. So that, and this is what had people worried, if this was meaning to be more than just a DDoS attack, which is a bandwidth flood, as we know, against targets in Ukraine, imagine if IP addresses throughout Ukraine were identified and all of the routers, all of the you know, consumer, small home, small office, small business routers were permanently wiped. This stage two payload overwrites flash and then reboots the router, bricking it. I mean, and permanently bricking it. At that point, you don't have firmware in order to reload the firmware. It's over. So the big concern was that this thing could have, I mean, like, while these people were in control, and, you know, we'll maybe be talking about this next week, because, as I said, there is a means for them to recover control unless the FBI was prepared to outreach into those routers and do something themselves. But there, you know, unfortunately, that's not legal. You're not able to go and modify anybody else's hardware, even if it's for a well-intended, benign purpose, like disinfecting them. At least in the U.S., that the law on that is very clear. So the stage three plugins are able to sniff the local network traffic to detect the presence of the SCADA, you know, SCADA, industrial control network traffic, and also further communicate with the botnet's command and control servers through the Tor network. All the communications is through Tor or TLS encrypted connections. So this thing is, you know, this is a seriously powerful, not a benign botnet. The big concern was that it might have been this. I mean, imagine if more than half a million routers self-destructed. Presumably, if it really is Russia, and it looks to me like the attribution is very solid on this. Cisco's Talos group wrote, "We assess with high confidence that this malware is used to create an expansive, hard-to-attribute infrastructure that can be used to serve multiple operational needs of the threat actor." Since the affected devices are legitimately owned by businesses or individuals, malicious activity conducted from infected devices could be mistakenly attributed to those who were actually victims of the actor. The capabilities built into the various stages and plugins of the malware are extremely versatile and would enable the actor to take advantage of devices in multiple ways. The Ukrainian Secret Service believed an attack was planned to take place on Saturday when the Ukrainian capital of Kiev was to be hosting the UEFA Champion League soccer final. The FBI confirmed that the botnet was created and was under control of the famous Russian state-sponsored cyber espionage unit known under many names. We've referred to them on the podcast as APT-28 and also Fancy Bear. They're also known by Sednit, Pawn Storm, SoFacey, Grizzly Step. Actually, that we've also talked about them under those terms. Strontium, SAR Team, and others. And an Estonian Foreign Intelligence Service, or the Estonian Foreign Intelligence Service, identified APT-22 as a unit of Russia military's main intelligence directorate, the GRU. So the command and control domain is under control of the FBI. Everybody has been asked to reboot. If you own one of those routers, do that at a minimum. But also, I would reflash. I would, you know, given that you are able to, certainly our listeners can, if you have one of those routers, get the latest firmware available for it and reflash it while you can. And Cisco did say that it did not appear to them that any zero-day vulnerabilities were responsible. They thought it was publicly known old vulnerabilities that had not been patched, which suggests that the affected routers do need updated firmware. While after you flash, remember, disable all WAN side network management. If you can, turn off universal plug and play on your LAN side as well. And by all means, use a non-default strong username and password to set this thing up. It's, you know, every week now we are talking about how these little appliance routers, which are workhorses. It's funny too, because I was thinking about how stage 2 and 3 live in RAM. On the other hand, our routers are probably the least often rebooted devices in our entire network. Everything else is being plugged in, unplugged, moved around, turned on, turned off. Those little routers sit there running for years at a time. So it's really not a handicap that this thing most of it lives in RAM. That's not a problem.
I think that's how the other ones, Mira bot and all those, are also RAM resident. They probably don't have enough way to write enough code in the firmware to keep it persistent.
Right. I would guess. It takes doing more.
Right.
And they're quite happy to live in RAM because their devices are unlikely to get rebooted.
If they do, they just reload.
Yep. Exactly.
So you put a couple of lines of code in the firmware that reloads it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Huh. So if you didn't have an affected router, do you think that list is complete, or is it conceivable other routers are affected and they just don't have the full list?
The problem is we have a sophisticated actor who in Cisco's parlance, a threat actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. State actor that wants to install their stuff everywhere.
Right.
And there are routers we know have been vulnerable to other things that we've been talking about recently that are not on that list. So it's certainly reasonable that in the future, other routers are going to get infected with this. So, more than 500,000 routers.
Yeah.
I would say there's never been a better time to make sure you're running the latest firmware.
Yeah. Reboot anyway, everybody, and then firmware update. And that's one reason we always argue for IoT devices that automatically update that have firmware patches.
Yes, 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 yes.
Because it's a pain to reflash your router. Yeah. And I bet you a lot of routers don't let you I know my Asus could reflash.
With the same version?
You could roll back if you wanted to, yeah.
Ah.
But a lot of the consumer-grade routers are made to be as simple as possible. And they just say, oh, no, you're up to date, and that's it.
Yeah.
In which case, I don't know what you'd do.
Yeah.
Get a better router. This is an opportunity to get a better router. Steve, good show as always. Very informative. Every week we do this, about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 yep. Eastern, 20:30 UTC if you want to watch on Tuesdays at twit.tv/live. You can also join us in the studio if you email tickets at twit.tv. It'd be my studio, not Steve's. Steve, as far as I know, does not have a live studio audience. Where would you sit?
Yeah.
Nowhere to put them. But we do love having a studio audience up here in Northern California if you come by. You can also get copies of this show on demand at your convenience. Of course, go to grc.com. That's Steve's website. That's where you'll find the audio copies and the transcripts as well, if you like to read along, or use the transcripts to search for parts of all of the 665 shows. You can also get other things at grc.com, including SpinRite, the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility, a must-have for all hard drive owners, grc.com. Everything else there is free. I used when I was suffering from jet lag, just couldn't get my schedule back. I used your healthy sleep formula, worked wonders, worked like a charm.
Cool.
Because, you know, the problem with jet lag, at least when you're going west to east, is you wake up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And so the ability to sleep through the night was critical to overcoming my Japanese jet lag.
Nice.
Thank you, Steve.
Oh, well, next week is 666.
Yes.
So hold on to your seats, folks.
The podcast of the beast.
Yeah.
Coming up. We will see y'all then. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, buddy. Security now.